say something.
Are you waiting to tap in?
Yeah, I'm just trying to find out
how well it's picking up.
And, what plans we need to make for the rest of the day. I thought I'd call Don Pride, see if we can see him.
What about some of these reporters?
That's what I was thinking.
Because we could probably eliminate a lot of guys if we,
go with some of those lists and pick up some.
Did you bring any copies of the outline with you?
Yeah, I've got them.
I was going to take some, I forgot the Jackson.
Here, I've got some over here.
Say Jacksonville or St. Pete and Tampa.
Interview with Don Pride, press secretary to Governor Rubin Askew. May 15th, 1974.
Well, I get the impression that political reporting is fairly aggressive in Florida.
Yeah, I think it's...
Is this something fairly new or not?
No, it's really sort of traditional. It started at least in the early 60s. Frank Trippett with the St. Pete Times, who later went with Newsweek and then Look Magazine, and Martin Waldron with the started out with the Tampa Tribune and then switched to the St. Pete Times after Trippett left. And there were some before then, but those are the ones that really stood out, I think. And it's a larger press corps. It may be the second largest, I think. California may be the largest. And it's just, I think it's unusual, the number of fairly good digging newspapers in the state. But all those factors have combined to make a pretty competitive situation for investigative reporting up here.
So it's pretty aggressive, and how much influence has that been on this? What I suppose should be called just exposure of corruption in state government.
Yeah, it's been a tremendous influence, not only on exposure, but getting good laws passed. They had the one of the earlier ones was the Who Gave It, Who Got It contributions law, which they're just now catching up with on a national level to require reporting of contributions.
Which goes back how long, Clark?
I guess at least as early as the mid-60s. I'm not sure when that passed. I think sometime, it could have been 62 or 64. Might have been 64. And it's been a good law, and it's enabled reporters to, although it's been weak as far as enforcement, it enabled the press to point out where the money's been coming from and to expose false listing of names and whatnot. For example, when I was with the St. Pete Times and Hayden Burns was running for re-election, he was backed by the Winn-Dixie chain and grocery chain based in Jacksonville and using their Convair airplane. And there was a big controversy because I found that the State Department of Transportation was paying for the engine, and things like that became campaign issues, and also directly relating to the election laws. It turned out that a bunch of when you check the names and the contribution reports against city directories, it turned out a lot of the people were clerks and bag boys for Winn-Dixie. You know, and you call them up and they say, I didn't give any money. I don't know why my name's on the list. And it's that sort of thing that the law has been effective in exposing. And then just now, in last year, they finally created an elections commission to begin enforcing it and, investigate violations. Up to now, it's just been exposure by the press and what effect that would have on the election, and I think it has had an effect. Burns was defeated.
You have the largest state press corps next to California in the country?
I think that's true, yeah. I've seen that.
Why is that?
I don't know. I think you got an unusual amount of papers ranging from what you might consider fair to good to very good in Florida when you compare them to other states. When you think about the Miami Herald and the St. Pete Times and Tampa Tribune and even some of the smaller ones like the Gainesville Sun and Miami News and Palm Beach Post and Lakeland Ledger. Gainesville Sun and the Ledger are owned by the New York Times now. But they're just interested in that kind of reporting. And I think it's been a strong factor. There are other, besides
the... Is there a focus on reporting on the state government administration? It can't be much on the legislature because that only meets for 60 days.
Yeah, but there's a lot more on the 60-day session than you see in other states, I think. Really? Like if you look at a Tampa Tribune, for example, they'll have a two-page spread on the session news.
Every day?
Every day, yeah.
How about the other paper?
And major stories, they start out front. It's closer to one page, but again, the major stories start out front and then they have devote a page inside to the session. The Herald does that, the St. Pete Times. And Times Union, it's got a state section that carries a lot of it. It just seems to be more interest in state government, I think, in Florida than in most states. I don't know why that is. It's a competitive situation between the papers. But besides the election reforms, which began in the mid-60s, you have Government in the Sunshine Law, which resulted from years of really pressing by the press corps here for open meetings. And was finally passed in 1967, requiring all collective bodies to meet in the open and to give proper notice. You got a very strong public records law, which has very few exceptions to what's public record and what isn't. And then I think in more recent years, it's gone into progressive legislation in the way of the environment, things like that.
Again, the press corps itself lobbies these things?
Well, they don't lobby them directly, but in effect, through the reporting and the combination of reporting and editorials,
isn't that atypical for the country?
I think so. Certainly to the extent that it's done in Florida. I was really amazed. I went up to one of those seminars at Columbia where you go through all the papers from the various states and the difference between what Florida Press does and what they do in other states is pretty dramatic when you look at it that way. So it certainly has been a strong force in Florida.
And this started in the early 60s?
Yeah.
Was it related to reapportionment or anything like that?
Well, it started before the 60s, come to think of it, because it really, guys, Triffitt and Waldron were here when Collins was governor. So it was at least as early as the mid-50s, and perhaps earlier to some extent, but that's when it really started to bloom, I think, was during that period. And
how about in campaign coverage?
Again, I think probably more aggressive than most states in the numbers of reporters put out on the road to cover the campaigns. In recent years, there's been more, at least the papers are starting to make an effort to do more than just report what the candidates are saying. But I think the reporting on the contributions is a
an aspect of that that started some time ago in Florida as being a key part of the campaign, you know, not just what the candidates are saying, but who's backing them and that sort of thing.
But the Sunshine Law and the campaign contributions law was essentially passed because of pressure from the campaign.
Yeah, very, very definitely. The a few of us held a sit-in in the Senate chamber in 66 or 67, I forget which it is now, and that was the last time that the Senate has held an executive session. And after that, they passed the Sunshine Law, which they'd been trying to pass for a number of years. There was a senator from Gainesville, Red Cross, that had been tried time and again and got nowhere. Finally did.
What happened on that sit-in? I'm just, were you there?
Yeah.
What?
There were a lot of speeches on the floor of the Senate, including one senator from Central Florida who said that
did he declare?
He felt like coming upstairs and throwing us out himself, and finally they got the, they took a vote, and the sergeant-at-arms came and escorted us out. But it was the last time they did it.
What happened there? I mean, they voted an executive session and you just didn't leave?
Right. They and it was just spontaneous. They held them to take up matters of suspension of officials, although there was always suspect that that they also, you know, went into other matters at some of these meetings. And we were in the press box and just... I forget who said it first, said, I'm not leaving. A couple other guys said, you know, they weren't leaving either. And it just caused a big stir on the floor down below. Most of the press did leave, and actually we went up and sat in the gallery, and they debated for a while, and then they took their vote, and then they escorted us out. But it was the last time that it happened.
Those that didn't leave went up to the gallery, is that the way it worked?
Right, which is, if you look up, there's a press box right at the back of the, overlooking the floor of the Senate, and the gallery's on both sides, it's the same area.
About how many people were involved?
I think there were four. John McDermott was one, and I was one. I forget who the other two were.
That was what year? 60.
It was either 66 or 67.
66 or 67. And that, was that the incident that triggered what eventually became the Sunshine Law?
I think so. I don't know for sure. And I can't recall for sure exactly when that. Passed, but I just read something the other day that indicated that was the trigger for it. I do know for sure that that was the last time the Senate ever met in secret. And I'm quite sure that law passed shortly after that, but I can't. My memory's not that good. I suppose they figured that, you know, if they weren't going to meet in secret, that no sense in letting the county commissions and the school boards and the city councils meet.
Was Florida the first state to pass such a law, do you recall?
I'm not sure. There's only a few now, I think. Maybe
Ian Neal says that was the case for a law that broad.
But even before they passed that, there was enormous, and I think that the incident in the Senate was just one of many over the years where the press, in their reporting, just made a big thing out of secret meetings, that it shouldn't be done, and in editorials. So every time they did it, you know, they did it at their own risk. And it's really amazing to me that that sort of thing isn't done, like, for example, in Washington, that they get away with so much secrecy up there. And, you know, you've got to feel that maybe it's partly because the press doesn't really want it that badly up there. They all have their sources, the ones that could really be pushing it effectively. I don't know. I think if the press wants it that badly, they can make it an issue.
How does SQ relate to the press?
Been very good relations.
Does he have regular press conferences?
Yeah, one or two a month. We try to have two a month.
When's the next one?
I don't know. We had one.
Stage one for us.
Yeah. We had one last week in which he announced for re-election. And since we're in the closing weeks of the session, we may not have another one this month. I'm not really sure. It depends on whether or not it looks like it'd be more productive for us not to say anything and just to work quietly for the program the rest of the way or what. We're in pretty good shape.
Can he serve unlimited terms? Are there two terms?
Two terms now. It used to be one, but the Constitution changed that in 68.
Was he involved in that constitutional?
Yeah, both as a member of the Constitution Revision Commission that started it off and then as a member of the Senate.
What did they have, a commission that drew up a constitution?
Yeah, and then they drafted it, and then the Senate and the legislature made quite a few changes.
And then it was presented to the people as a referendum?
Right. Chesterfield Smith, the president of the Bar Association, was the chairman of the commission. Very outspoken man, as you may have noticed in recent months on the Watergate situation. He's a damn good guy.
Where is he from?
Lakeland.
Is he active and politically active?
He is, particularly in judicial affairs, but he doesn't really try to get involved, I don't think, in campaigns and that sort of thing.
How does the cabinet... was the cabinet written into the new constitution? Is that the...
Well, it was in the old constitution, and then it just was retained without the people really knowing. I think, you know, that most people in Florida don't probably. This may be too broad a statement, but I think it's at least questionable whether they know that it's how the system works as far as having an elected cabinet. When problems come up, you know, sometimes we get letters indicating, questioning why the governor doesn't do something about so-and-so, you know, without realizing that he's a separate elected cabinet official who the governor has no power over. The system was improved, though, greatly by a combination of the Constitution passing, which set in motion the executive reorganization, and which put the Department of Administration, which is the budget, among other things, under the governor's control, and put several other major departments strictly under the governor that were under the cabinet. So it works better now, and there are certainly some good points in favor of it. One of them being the visibility of open meetings that you would not have otherwise on questions of selling submerged lands and buying environmental lands and parks. So in some ways it's worked pretty well. In other ways, in the administration of some of the departments, it just kind of a clumsy setup.
Is the Sunshine Law aspect written into the Constitution?
No.
That's what I thought, but you said in opening up...
No, I wasn't talking about that in relation to the... I'm talking about the cabinet system itself works well that way. Having the visibility that you would not have if there were just one chief executive, because they do make these collective decisions bi-weekly cabinet.
How many members in the cabinet?
Six, and the governor. So, and they're broken up into a number of different boards.
How many have been indicted?
One.
One so far, and how many others under investigation?
Apparently two. The comptroller and the insurance commissioner. He's called the treasurer and insurance commissioner, Tom O'Malley.
And then you've got the education commissioner, and who are the other?
The attorney general and the secretary of state and the commissioner of agriculture.
And what is the function of the cabinet?
Well, for one thing, they all have the different departments to run.
Right.
Beyond that, they meet collectively as boards, the board of education, the board of the trustees of the Internal Improvement Fund, which deals in submerged lands and that sort of thing, the Department of Natural Resources, the Board of Natural Resources, in which they run the Department of Natural Resources.
As the cabinet. The governor serves on the cabinet also. Chairman?
As chairman,
Do they meet at his pleasure? Or do they meet on a...
No, they have a regular schedule, which can't be changed except by majority vote.
But that's by custom or statute, or it's not written in the Constitution, I presume?
As far as when they meet?
Right.
That's regular just
meeting.
They can do that themselves. They used to meet once a week, and during the Kirk administration, he boycotted a lot of meetings. He wanted to change it, and the rest of the cabinet wouldn't. So he boycotted meetings every other week. And eventually, since that didn't work, he finally started going to all of them again. And Governor Askew was able to convince them to go to every other week.
But when they meet as the cabinet, is that right? And they can wear different hats as the meeting proceeds? Or do they meet as a...
Well, they meet as all these separate boards. It's the term cabinet, I'm not sure whether that's in the Constitution now or not, but it refers to what is really in effect these... a combination of boards, as which they meet as.
But I mean,
and
they
the press refers to it as cabinet meetings. But
they may meet this week as the Board of Education.
No, in each meeting, they keep changing hats.
Yeah,
all
that's
the way
what
through.
I know. Yeah. But the cabinet serves as the board, State Board of Education.
Yes.
With control over what? I mean, public schools, grades K through 12, or is it through
higher
education?
Well, we have a Board of Regents, which. Does most of the running of the university system, but on paper, at least, they're under the Board of Education, too. But it's mostly Board of Education stuff has always been routinely handled, except for example, an appeal by a teacher who's been fired that wants a hearing before the full cabinet. The rest of the agenda is usually handled by, upon the recommendation of the commissioner, you know, the board approves it. So in those kinds of things, except when it has involved things that would require some kind of hearing, it hasn't really made that much difference.
How about in so far as the budget is concerned? Does the governor prepare the budget?
Yeah, he's got complete control of that now.
Did the cabinet at one time?
Yes.
When did that change?
After the reorganization in 1968. The Constitution was passed in 68, and the reorganization came the following year, 69.
So that was actually Kirk's regime.
Yeah, would have started in the last year of Kirk's term, 1970.
So the governor actually prepares the budget and submits it to the legislature.
Right.
Who
he gets recommendations, of course, from the cabinet people for their departments, just like he gets them from the departments that are directly under him.
Does he appoint the other department heads?
Some he does and some he doesn't. The ones directly under the governor he appoints, those under the cabinet, they vary too. In some cases, the governor gets to appoint subject to approval of the cabinet. In others, it needs to be a majority vote of the cabinet. The Department of Natural Resources is by majority vote, so nobody really gets to initiate.
There's no system of boards or commissions of the various departments agencies, is there? How about the highway department, for example? Is there a state highway commission?
No, it used to be a state road board, but that was abolished. There is a state board of pollution control, which is a department under the governor, and he appoints the board. And there's a board of business regulation in the same way.
And what do you have, a highway department or a transportation department?
Department of Transportation.
What does that cover? Does it cover ports and aeronautics as well as highways?
No.
Or is it really just basically
highways? It's really highways and now mass transportation.
And you have a director that's appointed by the governor, is that basically
it? Yeah, you have a secretary of transportation appointed by the governor.
Traditionally, did the incoming governor change most of these officials, department heads, or do they sort of stay over from administration to administration?
Traditionally, they change them, the heads. Although, when more departments were under the... another thing that executive reorganization did was to cut down on the number of departments. They consolidated a bunch of them. But when all these departments were under the cabinet, I think there was less change than there is now, where the governor has direct control.
Do legislators serve on any boards and commissions?
Not within the executive, of course.
Within the 22 departments, do they serve on any?
No.
Ex officio?
No. They serve on a lot of task forces and things like that develop programs, but not directly.
The cabinet system, as it was, and even now, was unique to Florida, isn't that correct?
Yeah, right.
Even the way you've got it set up now, where you split the authority, he appoints about half of the 22. They still have enormous authority.
Right.
They got education, agriculture,
natural resources.
Natural resources, and the controller has the securities and insurance and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, some things don't even come under the cabinet, like banking. The controller has complete power over that.
And who appoints the controller?
He's elected. And he just issues charters, and that's been one of the exceptions to the public records law has been bank charter records, which is in the St. Pete Times did a series of stories, I guess it was last year, on how these are handled. You know, there's always
what's the origin of that system? How did that come about?
I don't know. That Alan Morris might be able to help on that.
How was the legislature in terms of its power in this state? Now it's since reapportionment, since the court choppers are gone.
It's become, I think it's always been fairly strong in Florida, and part of the reason in the past, I guess, was because of the weak governor system before the reorganization. And then, of course, the legislature was tightly controlled by what they call the pork chop gang, the rural members, before reapportionment.
Are they all gone now?
Just about, yeah. They just gradually, each session there would have been fewer, and just about all gone. Of course, you still have as far as being in control, except I don't think you could really classify Mallory Horn as a pork chopper, but of course he was very much in the rural block back when he was Speaker of the House, and now he's President of the Senate. And
has that been the biggest change in the legislature in the last 20 years?
Well, reapportionment, plus as a result of that, for the first time really having a staff. They used to rely so much on the lobbyists for the information. As a result, that there was no way to really question the lobbyists. In the recent years, they've come up, particularly on the House side, with strong staffing by aggressive, younger type people, you know, from the universities and that sort of thing. That's been good.
With a diminishing
effect of the lobbyists, yeah.
Is that a year-round staff or just during the session?
Year-round. And they have committee meetings just about year-round now.
How about legislative pay? What's happened there?
It used to be just a nominal